CliffCentral.com. It is the Burning Platform. Every Thursday we get to talk about things that are going on in current affairs. We get to talk about the world around us. We get to make, well, hopefully make some sense of it. And this morning we're going to be joined, first of all, by Canthan Pillay, who is like, he's our, oh my God, that was embarrassing. I didn't unmute myself. Oh, Jesus.
How now stupid. We're hearing you.
So I was talking about Eddie Van Halen and what a great guitarist he was, and I said he was in my top five, and he's in the pantheon of rock and roll forevermore. But we've got important things to get to. The Burning Platform this morning, which is brought to you by Nando's. And you can be a part of the Burning Platform. You can watch us live if you go to cliffcentral.com, or you can listen to the podcast a bit later on. We're joined, as ever, by Canthan Pillay, but this morning also by Martin van Staden, who is the head of legal at the Free Market Foundation. That's policy and research. Hey, Canthan, what's happening, man?
I was just experimenting with this new snap camera, which enables me to turn off my beard, which was kind of interesting.
Did it make you look younger or older?
No, it made me look weird.
Well, you could always be you could always play around with what you might look like if you were a transgender person, thanks to a lot of the software, and that would be fascinating.
Well, I don't know about the transgender part. I mean, have you ever assumed my gender, Gareth?
I haven't really. Are you going to Camps Bay to occupy a house that isn't yours and take ownership of it in order to call it a protest to lengthen your holiday by a few more days?
No, that's you know, my culture considers stuff like that to be tacky, so we don't do things like that.
Oh, okay. Well, it's interesting that you're...
We persuade people to sell us the house at a discount. That's what we do.
That's very good, but that's also stereotypical, and if you weren't Indian, you said that possibly racist way to look at things.
No, of course I'm a racist. You know, a racist is you know, someone who feels complete disdain for the human race generally, and that's me.
All right, so before we get into the nitty-gritty, I didn't just mean to bring up this Camps Bay occupation because I think it's trivial and silly, and it is. But I also brought it up because what we'll be talking to Martin about this morning. Hey, Martin, how are you?
Hey, good and you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What we're going to be talking to Martin about this morning is essentially property rights. So before we even get into that, and I know that Martin and Canthan, you're both well-versed in this. I mean, I could give it a try, but I'm probably going to fall over myself. Explain why property rights matter and why they're at the center of any functional economy. Canthan, do you want to have a go?
No, I think I'd actually like to let Martin climb in on this because I've expressed my views previously that property rights are the fundamental rights that drive all of civilization. And in the absence of property rights, everything else collapses. But Martin, let's hear what you have to say.
Yeah, no pressure, Martin. Define the whole of basic economics for us.
Yeah, no, I mean, Canthan is totally right. I mean, property rights, I think, can be classed as a broader notion of freedom, and that's definitely the pillar of at least modern civilization as we know today. But at least as far as the economy goes, I think common sense tells us that you won't see any foreign investment, and certainly also no local investment, if people simply know that what they the effort, the time, the money they put into stuff today simply will be taken tomorrow, whether by government or by protesters for whatever cause, that just won't happen. So there won't be any development, no capital expansion.
Why would people try to improve their lives if they can't hold on to the things that make their lives better, basically?
No, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's it's a matter of incentives. And that's why the Free Market Foundation, for instance, has been so keen on title deeds for indigent people living on state land, because we continue to see today all around South Africa, you look at satellite images, you see townships, not necessarily shanty towns, but you see townships which are very brown and dusty still, even though there are formal houses, and you have suburbs which have trees and swimming pools and stuff like that. You don't see that in townships, and I think you can trace that very directly to the lack of incentives to to develop the property, because the municipal government still owns those properties. And theoretically, although I don't know if this necessarily happens in practice, theoretically, one morning the municipality can show up and say, yeah, we're building a mall here. So goodbye. So it's all about incentives.
So, Martin, I just think I'm going to pause you for a second, because I think it's sure. probably merited for us to give some credit to the Free Market Foundation. Leon Lowe has been instrumental in the Free Market Foundation, and as have all the other people there, in trying to get people in the townships in South Africa and in informal settlements where there've been people living there for more than a generation to try and get people title deeds. And that process has actually been tremendously fruitful. There are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of South Africans who now actually own property and didn't before. And this is a very big deal, because if you don't own property, you have nothing to borrow against, first of all. And second of all, as you say, why would you improve a house? Why would you improve a place? It's not a cultural thing. If it's yours, you want to improve it. You want to look after it. You know, people don't leave their wallets lying around for other people to grab, because they know that the value of that wallet is in the currency in it, the cards in it, the identity stuff in it, and the actual wallet itself. If it doesn't belong to them, they may as well just leave it lying around. And the same goes for fixed property.
Yeah, no, we see this in history as well. I don't have numbers, but I've seen the story being told a number of times. In the Soviet Union, when it came to agriculture, so obviously the state collectivized farms, but it still allowed, to some extent, small plots of land, allowed individuals to have their own very, very small private farms, and they were allowed to sell the produce there. And the result of that was that these very, very small private plots of agriculture outproduced the massive state farms, I think, without exception. So it's, we just see this. People put time, money, and effort into what is theirs, and when it belongs to so-called everyone or to the state, it just doesn't happen.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that about the Soviet Union. I know about the collective farms, the kolkhoz and sovkhoz farms, but you're telling me that even in a situation where the government is completely trying to engineer everything to do with private property, even in those situations, the smallest properties that are privately held outperform the big state ones. That's such a – I mean, that's case closed, right?
Yeah,
except that would be something that would be self-evident to most of us, I would think.
Mm.
The really interesting thing for me, guys, is that if you drive through the Eastern Cape, and you can immediately see the distinction between land that is privately owned and land that is feudal land. You know, in other words, it falls under some or other traditional authority. And these traditional authorities have no interest whatsoever in giving people ownership of the land, so people do not take care of the land. Mm. So you see these patches literally as you drive through the former Transkei and the former Ciskei, where suddenly there's lush, verdant green, and you can see everything is well maintained.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get across to places where there are dongas all over the place. There's erosion. Cattle are grazing indiscriminately. You know, the entire terror of driving through Transkei, because there are no fences up to keep the animals in check, because people don't have a vested interest in putting up fences on land that doesn't belong to them. It really is that simple. Now, if you consider the sheer cost in terms of road deaths that occurs in the Eastern Cape alone every single year from the fact that people happen to run into cows. I mean, I ran into a cow at Mount Aleph some years ago. You know, just came up over the top of a blind rise, and there it was in the middle of the road, and it was like kind of playing snooker, you know. My vehicle stopped, and the cow went flying. And did I tell anyone about it? No, I drove all the way to Kokstad before I reported the damage to my car, because, you know, people would have come after me then. But I digress.
Yeah, I want to take this into the meta discussion now, because we've laid the groundwork here, and expropriation without compensation is something that's been on everybody's minds for the last 3 years, probably. It's something that hasn't gone away. The government seems dead set on this idea, but they're taking it, in your opinion, Martin, because I've read a couple of your articles, they're taking it in the wrong direction. There's nothing wrong with the Constitution. We don't need a constitutional amendment, according to you. The Constitution is fine. It's the government itself and their ability to execute or not execute on the Constitution that is the problem. Explain that again to people who have the opposing view that it's important that we expropriate land and that we expropriate private property from individuals because we need to make this a more egalitarian society. Explain why that's problematic.
Okay, so I think let's start with the second part of that, then I'll get to the Constitution after. It's important to distinguish between, I guess, three things. The first thing is restitution. Second thing is redistribution. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is nationalization. So restitution is something that I've actually, to my surprise, found that everyone agrees on. AfriForum, EFF, everyone agrees on restitution because it's a simple matter of justice. It is that if your land or the land of your ancestors was seized by the colonial or apartheid regimes, and you can prove that, and I think it's very provable in the South African context, then of course you must receive your land back. And if you don't want the land, then the government must pay you equal amount of money, at least to the market value of the land. And everyone agrees. There is no dispute about that. The redistribution is when the government has a look around South Africa and it thinks, huh, look at all this nice private land there. It would be a shame if something were to happen to that. And it grabs that from individuals, from real owners, the people who bought that land, who didn't steal it, who didn't receive stolen land. It's actually, in fact, their land. It gets seized from them, expropriated with or without compensation. And then that land gets given in ownership to someone else who is unrelated to that land. So this is where something like dishing out land to political allies comes in, or even bona fide redistribution to the indigent comes in. But this very rarely also happens in South Africa. Usually I think it goes to political allies, and rarely in ownership. That's another problem we should get to. And then the last thing, nationalization, which I think is probably the most common thing that happens in South Africa, is that private land is seized with or without compensation from the real actual owners, and the government keeps it, and then it leases it out to people. So those are the three things that we need to distinguish, and we need to bear in mind that if we're talking about real land reform, we want to empower citizens, we want to redress the injustices of apartheid, then we need to focus on restitution. We need to give people ownership of property that is actually theirs and was taken from them illegitimately or from their ancestors in the past. Now, if we want to do land reform totally wrong, then we want to give the state ownership of land for the reasons we've already outlined, or we just want to indiscriminately and randomly dish out land legitimately owned by people to some other people, which, I mean, there is no justice to that. So the Constitution takes cognizance of this, and there are arguments that the Constitution allows for redistribution of land. Now, as of this year, I have a master's degree in law. I've read the Constitution many times. I don't see it. Maybe I'm an idiot. I have read Section 25 many times. I do not see any justification for redistribution or nationalization of land anywhere. The Constitution does a few things. Firstly, it protects private property rights. It regulates expropriation. That's the amendment that for expropriation without compensation is changing the regulation of how expropriation is done in South Africa. Then it says that people who have insecure tenure in South Africa, that tenure must be secured for them. That's what the FMF is doing with its titling process, and it's something government must also be doing itself. Then it also provides for restitution. And then it also says that government must provide an environment where must foster conditions for equitable access to land. So none of that has anything to do with redistribution or nationalization. The Constitution says strengthen property rights, strengthen tenure, create good conditions for land ownership, and restitute land. And to me, that's perfect. And that's why I argue that the Constitution, there's no reason for it to be amended unless government wants to make it easier to engage in redistribution and in nationalization, which I think is obviously exactly what government's agenda is. And we should all be very concerned about that.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's the entire kind of intellectual argument around this stuff. My point around this is very simple. We only need expropriation without compensation as a political weapon to foster hatred. It's the only reason that it actually exists. And the reason why I say this is because we have consistently paid out over the course of the years to expropriate legally and with compensation. Now, what are the stumbling blocks right now in terms of land redistribution? There are none. Think about it. The average farm, let's say you there's a farm that's worth, I don't know, 10 million mm-hmm. as an example.
Yeah.
You know, you consider the billions that we spend on a daily basis. I mean, currently, in terms of our budget deficit, we're running at a budget deficit of R1 billion a day. Sure. Just consider that we could just increase that budget deficit by an extra R1 billion, buy out all of these farms and hand them over legally. No. Exactly what the ANC is doing with this is they are fomenting racial hatred. It's the only reason why they are doing this. Mm-hmm. Because the country can actually afford to do this thing legally within the Constitution.
So
this is a smokescreen. It allows these guys to steal and put the blame on apartheid.
All right.
But show me a single example where there is a person who has refused to sell farm at market rates, and the government has not been able to afford to pay whatever has been asked. Everyone's willing to sell if the price is appropriate. I mean, our farmers can pretty much pick up and start businesses pretty much anywhere in the world, and they've been known to do this. This is a smokescreen. You know, we can talk about what the Constitution says, but it was never about that. Mm. It has always been about the politicking. Prove me wrong.
Canton, no, that being the point, I'd like to just digress slightly here. And Martin, you can take a back seat for a minute because I want to hear Canton's thoughts on this. There was a massive protest outside the Senekal court just 2 days ago. And in fact, it wasn't yesterday, it was the day before. In fact, people were incensed because a young farm manager in his early 20s was tortured and killed in an apparently racially and just an ugly murder. It was motivated by whatever, but it certainly wasn't property. We've seen a number of cases of farm murders making the headlines, but not nearly as many as we suppose that there might be. And the fact that these are not crimes of opportunity, that these are crimes that seem almost, from the point of view of the farmers themselves, they say that it appears to them it's a targeted attack, and that farmers are under threat and farm workers are under threat, and they're constantly imperiled, and they're getting no support from security services. Becky Cele told them to shut up the other day. The president has said there's no such thing as farm murders publicly a number of times. What do we make of this, Canton? Is there something very serious going on, and could this be the sharp edge of the wedge? And are we going to see, Julius Malema irresponsibly tweeting that he reckons this is the start of a race war, essentially asking his people to come to the court so that they could fight the Bura. I mean, it's all very, very disturbing. And for people who think that we have reached a point of civilization in this country where we don't have to defer to these kinds of arguments, this is very disappointing. What is your overall take on farm murders? Do you think that that is as much a political issue as the expropriation without compensation issue is?
Look, I think that there's a particular propensity for brutal violence among the criminal class of our country that you see in very few countries in the world. Let's be very clear that farm murders are happening as farm murders. There are black farmers who are getting murdered as well.
Absolutely.
As a category of crimes, is farm murder something very specific? Absolutely. There's a disproportionate number of people per capita that are getting murdered who happen to be on farms. This is absolutely true. And part of the reason why this has, in fact, happened comes back to the fundamentals of property rights, if you think about it, because your right to defend yourself on your property and to retain possession of your property and to protect your property is something that really cuts through to the chase in terms of all your other rights, you know, your rights for to secure your person and so forth. Now, if the law tells you that if a person occupies your property and if you act in self-defense against that person, you are the first person who is going to be liable for criminal charges, it's a fundamental flaw in terms of the way in which we are running our country. You know, I like the example of a couple of days back, there was this group of pulled a home invasion in Durban. And the woman turned around and took out two of them and wounded the third. And I assure you that there is not a single person, black or white, around the country who happens to be a homeowner who did not turn around and say, hallelujah, that we need to see more of this stuff actually happening. What you have had is a scenario on the farms where you've effectively disempowered the ability of farmers to take care of themselves. And they used to have, you know, a very large-scale equivalent of neighborhood watches, effectively, where they would look out for each other. And there would effectively be resources that would be provided by the state that would enable them to run these. And these were shut down. But this has been part of the systematic disarming of the civilian populace. At the same time, you consider that the biggest source in terms of illegal firearms in this country happens to be the police themselves. So what this ANC government has been doing is they've been systematically removing the ability of people to protect themselves.
Well, Bekkie Taylor even said yesterday that he thinks that private gun ownership is a really bad idea and he wants to eradicate it.
Absolutely, and this has been part of their gameplay from the get-go.
They're actually saying the quiet part out loud now. They're not even trying to disguise it.
Absolutely correct. And, you know, those of us who actually believe that in the absence of a state that's able to actually enforce the law at the most basic level, it falls upon citizens to protect themselves. And, you know, really, I say this to people all the time, get yourself trained in how to use a firearm. And I don't want to be, you know, come across as hypocritical here, because I don't own a firearm myself. I keep telling people that. But I do believe that if you happen to be in any of those categories where you are potentially vulnerable, get yourself trained, get yourself licensed, because the state is not going to save your life when they come for you. But I think the problem in terms of farm murders, to go back to it very specifically, we must avoid the scenario of trying to turn it into a race issue. It isn't a race issue. Mm-hmm. It is really a question of the ANC's entire power of disarming its citizenry, because they don't really care whether you happen to be black or white. As long as you oppose their position at any level, they want to disarm you. You know, we just need to be very clear about that.
All right. So it's about gun rights. It's about property rights. It's not actually about race. It's being used for political purposes, and it's being turned into a narrative that sometimes plays into race, but we shouldn't fall for that nonsense. That's what you're saying.
Yes. Well, in fact, what we should be doing is pointing out that there's a prima facie case of incitement on the part of Julius Malema, and, you know, surely that's grounds for immediate arrest. And why is there not a clamor on a daily basis to actually haul out everything that he says at that level and say, this guy is actually stirring violence and he's stirring incitement. And the interesting thing in terms of that protest at Senegal, I don't know if you guys have seen the leaked video of the guy then subsequently setting fire to the overturned cop van. And certainly, you know, honing on that picture, and there was not a trace of whiteness on that person's face.
And you mean the car was not set alight by a white person?
Exactly right. Okay. So the question is, who's fomenting the violence?
But the media are also complicit in this, because the media have turned a blind eye to the inconvenient narrative of white people being the victim here, or farmers being the victim. And that's also added to the problem, because now it's very difficult to discern what is true and what is not.
Which is why I'm saying that the entire way in which we end up engaging with this stuff, and Martin, I come back in your direction in terms of this. we tend to get philosophical around things like land rights, around expropriation, and we go to the Constitution and so forth. No, I think the common narrative has always has to be, as a country, we can afford to have expropriation that's legal. And this is a smokescreen by the ANC to stir racial hatred. That needs to be the sole message. Every time anyone talks about expropriation, don't engage with these guys. Don't dignify them by sitting on their panels. Just bludgeon them into submission, saying the country can afford legal expropriation, and you guys are doing this to foment racial hatred while you are stealing. And we need to get back to those core messages. Ditto in the case of farm murders. Steer away from everyone who tries to turn it into a racial narrative. Essentially, the ANC is asset stripping the people so that they can steal everything that you own. And the police that end up being behind these robberies fundamentally are all on the payroll of the ANC. Core messages.
Look, you're totally right about this being politically motivated. For instance, the land claims court, which is supposed to be one of the primary movers for land reform, as one permanent judge. We're a country of almost 60 million people. We have this apparently massive land hunger, but they can't appoint more than one permanent judge to the land claims court. And as you say, the money is there. Even if we forget about restitution, which I think we shouldn't, and just go for total redistribution, you're absolutely correct. The government wastes billions of rands every year without exception on things like South African Airways and the 400-700 other state-owned enterprises that do zip for this country, which they could be all throwing into redistribution.
They could solve the land problem overnight if they decided to.
Let's go back to basics, Gareth. Don't even acknowledge that there's a land problem. I'm saying there's no land problem.
Yeah, exactly.
There is no land problem. It's a smokescreen.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, let's look at a few other things, because while we've got Martin here, I know he pays attention to the news and he's interested in what's happening. So has Ace Magashule been served with a warrant of arrest or not? Because it seems very confusing. We had reports from IOL, again, not necessarily trustworthy. They've been fake news some of the time before. They said on Tuesday night, it looks like Ace Magashule might have been arrested or he's been served with this warrant. Then on the morning after, we were told that the Hawks had no idea about this warrant. They thought it was made up. But Ace had admitted that he had received a warrant of arrest. And now nobody seems to know what the truth is. Who the hell can we believe here? Is this a move in the right direction, or is it another Keystone Cops, people falling over their own feet situation?
I think Ace is lying. You know, who receives a warrant of arrest? I mean, have you ever received a warrant of arrest in the post that says, hey, we're coming to you?
No.
Or you a delivery person pitch up at your house and say, hey, you know, just to give you advance notice, the cops are coming. If Ace has got a warrant of arrest, you know, you can hold it up in the air and say, here it is. And here's what it says. Okay. Essentially, what he's doing is he's preempting the possibility that something is actually coming for him. And this is building a victim narrative in advance. Mm-hmm. It's really as simple as that. Is there potentially truth in the suggestion that he's going to be arrested? Well, on the face of things, based on, you know, all evidence that we have on so many cases of corruption, yes, there would be a prima facie case that he should end up having his day in court, as Jacob Zuma is so fond of saying. Do I presume that he's guilty? No, I don't presume he's guilty. That's why we have courts. We want him to go to court. And, you know, let's have the courts actually work out what's going on. But this is all political grandstanding. It's really to try and stir these divisions that already exist within the ANC and try and stave off any possibility so that when if he does end up getting arrested, it's going to be, see, I told you so. My sources were correct.
Martin, do you think that we're making any progress here? Because maybe some people are starting to say the NPA is waking up. We saw just this week VBS Mutual Bank, the CFO, Philip Truter, was expected to give extensive details as to what has transpired. But he's been sentenced effectively to 10 years in prison for running VBS into the ground and for making it a corrupt business opportunity for a whole lot of cadres, including potentially some people in the EFF, which we'll get to later on. But there's also been the Edwin Sodi arrests this last few days. So do you think we're starting to see law enforcement managing to find some semblance of executive authority again, starting to actually do the things we're paying them to do?
Call me cynical. I am not convinced that the way the system is currently set up, that we will ever see high-profile political people, corrupt political people, spending anything more than a few months in any type of real South African prison. I haven't seen that. I may be wrong, but I haven't, even in cases where there were clear factional differences between the ruling party and factions within it and other political parties, that has never happened. The example of Julius Malema was mentioned earlier. He has engaged in indisputable incitement of violence repeatedly throughout the last few years, and he has not spent one evening in jail. Charges have been filed against him, but I don't think that is ever going to happen. I don't think the system is geared towards that, and I think we need to see that in the context of again in the whole push for land reform, expropriation without compensation, government's agenda, and maybe I should say broader than government, the political class's agenda is to eliminate any semblance of a strong civil society. That means that only business people will spend time in jail. Landed properties will be expropriated. A landed citizenry is very independently minded, and that's not something that a government and a political class keen on power can allow. So we must see everything in the context of undermining the private, undermining the civil, as opposed to the political. It's a very centralizationist agenda that's going on, and I think the lack of action around corruption is probably and yeah, definitely part of that. I would be genuinely surprised if we have a single high profile politician in South Africa found guilty of corruption spending years in prison. I haven't seen that. I do not think we are going to see that, and I think the requirement for us to get there will need to be a substantive change in national government at an election. I think that's the only way we can actually get there.
Well, now that you've depressed everybody, do you think that that's a likely outcome? Is that potentially something that can happen? Or is it just pie in the sky? Because we've discussed this a number of times with all kinds of people from various NGOs, from the analysis point of view. And some of them say it is, and some of them say it isn't. What is your position?
Yeah, no, I would say it's certainly possible. The ANC has basically given over power on a subnational level. It has relinquished control of the Western Cape, of municipalities. I think I lean slightly towards it giving up power should it lose a national election. I don't think it's necessarily guaranteed, but I'm a little bit optimistic about that happening. And it's certainly possible. I think the ANC has clearly been losing votes, and it's somewhere in the 50% now. The obvious problem is that it has certain allies in parliament, which bolster its numbers. So if it had to enter into a coalition, it would have partners in that respect. But similarly, the opposition has historically shown that it can also organize quite well. So I think it's absolutely conceivable to see South Africa entering into an era of coalition governments, where the ANC isn't necessarily part of that coalition. I think it's probably going to be a difficult road, but I think it's possible. Yeah.
All right. Let's turn our attention further afield. And there is no more appropriate time than a month before. In fact, we've got less than a month to the US elections. This has consequences for the whole world. I know both of you also been as obsessed with this stuff as I am, but there is some fatigue setting in because I think people are exhausted. They're exhausted by Donald Trump, who's an exhausting person, even if he's doing, in some people's opinion, more right than wrong, and in other people's opinion, more wrong than right. It's so emotional. Some people are extremely easily triggered by the mere mention of his name. There isn't an enormous amount of enthusiasm for Joe Biden, but there's a huge amount of dislike for Donald Trump. So as much as he says that his rallies are bringing in millions and millions of people, he's also not, you know, he's not acknowledging the fact that many people on the left are not seriously pro-Biden, but they're definitely anti-Trump. We've got only a few days to go. Last night was the debate, which I doubt you would have seen. It was at 3 o'clock in the morning. So very few people would have watched that and stayed up to watch Mike Pence debating Kamala Harris. But Kamala Harris is important in this election. She's the furthest left person in the Senate. She's the most radical person in the U.S. Senate at the moment. She's a former prosecutor. She was plucked out of relative obscurity after dropping out of the primary before she even had a vote in her own state of California in her favor. So a lot of people are saying not the strongest candidate. But then many others are saying, well, she's healthy. She's young. She is definitely a creature of the left. And that is the way that the Democratic Party are going. The agenda is not being set by people like Joe Biden. It's being set by people like Bernie Sanders and AOC and Ilhan Omar and those kinds of people. So maybe Kamala is the perfect creature for them to inject their ideas into. If that's true, she may be more important in this discussion than Joe Biden is. He's in ailing health. Certainly mentally, he's not as clear as he was when he was vice president under Barack Obama. What do you guys think is going on in American politics right now? What are you interested in? What are you watching carefully? Do you believe the polls, which show that he's opened up his lead on Donald Trump in double digits in some places, including swing states?
Martin, you want to go first?
Yeah, no, I think I probably have the least to say about it. I'm not a big follower of the U.S. election, but I think this year and maybe last year as well in U.S. politics has been a time of rejecting police brutality and the criminal justice system. So I found the appointment of Kamala Harris to be an incredibly misinformed choice given the context of the politics of the left in the United States currently, because these protests and riots, to be frank, are usually leftist inspired. Not that I'm saying their concerns are invalid. Much of them definitely are. But Kamala Harris was from what I know, I'm no expert, but was a brutal prosecutor of minor crimes in California while she was, I think, the attorney general. So I was quite taken aback by what seemed to me to be a senseless appointment for vice president. I think that he should have looked a bit longer and harder.
I know, but you've totally missed the point. It's purely about window dressing in the Democratic Party at the moment. She's a woman and she's of color, and that's sufficient for many people.
You don't think that the fact that she contributed to the very thing that the left is literally up in arms about would steal some votes from them? I don't know.
Stop expecting people to be logical. Canton, what's your point of view on this? I know you've got lots to say.
No, I don't have that much to say, actually. Look, what this comes down to basically is whether the parties are able to sufficiently motivate people to get to the polls. Now, consider this, that if every single person who had voted for Barack Obama in 2012 had actually then voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, she would be president. Mm-hmm. But they were not able to motivate people to actually get out to the polls and actually cast their vote. Now, my take on this very clearly is that you are far more likely to go out to the polls to vote for something, not if you dislike something. Mm-hmm. So it's very clear in our country, as an example, that there's an overwhelming dislike of the ANC because the majority of people stay away from the polls. But at the same time, we've never been able to motivate the masses to actually go out and vote for someone else, simply because the someone else doesn't have something that they necessarily buy into. Now, apply the same logic in terms of the United States and ask yourself whether the entire campaign right now of the Democratic Party in the United States has not been about what they stand for, but what they stand against. Mm. And what they stand against is Donald Trump.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, Donald Trump's supporters, no matter what you might think of them, you call them deplorables, as Hillary Clinton did back in the day, but they're very clear about what they stand for. They actually stand for the entire core message of make America great again. And people actually buy into that. And if you ask yourself which of those two core messages is going to be more likely to get people to go out to the polls, my opinion very simply is that it's going to be Trump's message that's going to get people out there. So, you know, I said a couple of days ago, and, you know, people have been quite uptight about this prediction of mine. Let me just see what I said. I said I'm predicting a comfortable Trump victory. Mm-hmm. I said I predict he'll carry Florida, Michigan, Minnesota, Pennsylvania. And the other thing that I said was also predict many voters will be positively swayed by his nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court.
Do you think, and again, this is really a point of some conjecture, so we're going to make up our answer here based on some things that are not entirely logical or fact-based, but it might have just a little bit of intuition attached to it. Do you think that COVID and surviving COVID is going to be something that Trump will be able to play in his favor? Or do you think it's something, because he caught COVID in the first place, that the Democrats will be able to play as some sort of failure on his part?
Well, I think the fact that he came out of COVID as quickly as he did has played to his entire narrative. And his entire narrative from the get-go has been that the entire idea of shutting down the economy is a bad thing to do. So it's now going to be really difficult for people to turn around and justify a continued shutdown, which is what Biden has been saying from the get-go. Now, if you consider that Biden's wanting to shut down the economy versus Trump saying we need to open up everything, and it's actually easy to end up beating this particular thing, it becomes really difficult now for the Democrats to continue pushing that narrative. The narrative that the Democrats have now switched to is to say, oh, yeah, it was very easy for Trump to be able to do this because he's trying to take away your health care. And guess what? You know, he's making use of health care at the state expense. So that has been the shift in narrative right now. And once again, it's not a question of here's what we stand for. It is a question of look what a bad person Trump is. And we need to vote this guy out of office. And you know, I suspect most people are going to turn around and say, and then what?
Yeah. Martin, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think Canfin is basically right. I think that the message of opening up the economy after the obvious futileness of lockdowns all around the world and in the United States leading to mass unemployment as well, or not mass unemployment, great unemployment, will just sell better at an election than saying we need mandated masks and continued lockdowns. So I think this is going to be a push for Trump, sure.
Well, people are really hedging their bets here to some degree, but a lot of people are going all in on one of the candidates. You can see there's increased emotive involvement for so many Americans in these discussions. The media have not exactly played an objective role here either. They lost their collective minds the other day when he got out of hospital and took off his mask on the balcony. There was no one around him at the time. And even if there was, those people have probably either been tested or have also already been through COVID.
Someone did the calculation. The nearest person was 100 feet away. It's 30 meters away.
All right. So he took off his mask, and people like Chris Cuomo on CNN had a complete meltdown. It was like a hissy fit, like you would see a child tantruming in the supermarket. Why do you think the media are so invested in a Joe Biden presidency? And really, they have Trump to thank for great ratings. They have Trump to thank for their talking points every night. The media in America should be on their knees begging for more of him. It's been good for their business.
I don't think we should pick on media in the United States, Gareth. I think that this is a problem that media has in the world right now. And the issue really is that media spends far too much time on Twitter. And Twitter is, firstly, people forget that as a representative sample of the populace, Twitter is minuscule. It's not even statistically significant in terms of being able to gauge support.
And that's why we can't rely on it as an ongoing poll, right? It's also not indicative of any sort of social trend in any meaningful way.
Absolutely not, because if you consider that the majority of people who actually end up running the world's economy, you know, as in people who go out to work on a daily basis, they don't have time to spend on Twitter. Now, I happen to be one of those people who every so often I can take a break from what I'm doing and hop onto Twitter during the course of the day and, you know, generally put out some pearls of wisdom or just end up trolling, generally speaking. But it's because I've got the luxury of being able to do that. Now, there are particular categories of people who are able to do that on an ongoing basis. Mm. Primarily, they work in academia. And as such, they once again have a very echo chamber oriented approach to the way in which they engage with the world. But consider, you know, the guy who happens to be a forklift driver at Macro, who gets in at the crack of dawn and he's, you know, literally moving those crates all over the place, all around the time. And you never get to hear from that person. The guys who are trudging up and down the streets collecting the recyclables, you never get to hear from those people. The taxi drivers in our country, you know, who are among the wealthiest of our people, do they ever stop to tweet? I don't think so. Hmm. So the problem is that journalists are spending time on Twitter. No. And it's become self-reinforcing because one of them says something and they all say, yes, you know, yeah, let's all agree. And then someone says, look how horrible this is. And everyone says, yes, we all agree. Mm. People are pushing issues that most people don't believe are actually existent. So, for example, take Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
Okay. Surveys have shown overwhelmingly that the majority of people in the United States believe all lives matter. Yeah, yeah. Let's be very clear about this. Okay. Overwhelmingly, they say, all lives matter. Okay. Are they opposed to police violence? Yes. Do they believe that politicizing of the killing of black people by police officers is something that's meant to sow division? Yes. Do they believe that race relations in the United States are better than they've ever been in history? Yes. Journalists have an entirely different view of this because they are busy in the echo chamber of Twitter. And so now let's take the case of Roe versus Wade. And, you know, for the benefit of people who don't understand what Roe versus Wade is all about, it comes back to the question of abortion rights. Uh-huh. Now, abortion in the United States, unlike Italy, for example, where abortion was legalized by a national referendum, abortion in the United States was legalized by a Supreme Court decision, which was a famous case of Roe versus Wade, which finally gave people the right to actually have abortions. For the longest time now, the Democratic Party has been saying that we need to keep liberals on the court because otherwise they are going to take away your rights to have an abortion. Mm-hmm. And this is patently untrue because the Reagan Supreme Court, which was the most conservative Supreme Court that was ever appointed in the United States history, it put strictures in place around Roe versus Wade, such as, you know, the fact that you're not able to have third-term abortions, except under cases of absolute emergency. But they did not tamper with it. Mm. And there is absolutely no reason why the current Supreme Court, remember that there's a current conservative majority on the Supreme Court. And they show no inclination to want to tamper with this as well. So again, the question of abortion becoming a core issue in this election is just wrong. The majority of Americans don't care about it.
Yeah.
They do care about reproductive rights. They do care about access to birth control, but all of those
but
things.
But it's highly unlikely that the court will, in any case, change their decision on Roe versus Wade, even if there is a conservative majority with Amy Coney Barrett on the court. It doesn't look like something that they can backpedal on. Plus, it's a state issue, right? As I understand it, up to that decision, the states were able to, for themselves, decide what their position was.
That's correct. And in fact, Trump's point has always been that he doesn't have a standpoint on abortion, but he believes that the rights should devolve down to the states. Mm. And if you think about it, that this, you know, basically ends up being one of those philosophical questions. Do I believe that the most power should devolve down to the lowest possible local authority? Absolutely. I mean, policing, for example, do I believe that people in local communities should have the right to elect their own police chief? Yes, absolutely. The question in terms of abortion, though, is that it ends up being a question of whether this is a fundamental right. So I think all of us, for example, can agree that the right to personal freedom, in other words, the right to not be a slave, is a fundamental right, and that should not be subject to decision by a state or a local authority.
Mm-hmm.
But again, let's not forget that if it had not been for an edict that was issued by a Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, that freed the slaves, because remember, they were not freed by the 14th Amendment until much later. It was basically a presidential decree that said, I'm declaring that slavery is now...
The Emancipation Proclamation.
Yes, it's declaring that slavery is now illegal. So now the question in terms of abortion is whether you need to devolve that right down to the level of the states. Now, I'm one of those people who believes on the abortion debate that fundamentally the question for me is whether the choice for a woman to have an abortion should rest with the state or rest with the woman. And fundamentally for me, no matter what your moral perspective has to be, I cannot in any way support a position where you hand over to the state the right to determine what to do with your body. So it cuts to the chase of that philosophical argument. No matter what you might believe in terms of what moral imperatives should be, ultimately, if a woman has the ability to terminate her own life, it means fundamentally that you need to recognize that.
And the same goes for property rights, to bring it full circle, because we're out of time.
But that is the core of property rights, the security of your body and to make your own decisions.
You own your own meat vehicle.
You own your own meat vehicle. But again, we put strictures in place around this stuff, So we say, for example, that, you are free to do what you want to with your body, but only once you become a legal major.
Yeah.
So, so my daughter, for example, I didn't allow her to pierce her ears when she was a kid.
Yeah.
As soon as she turned 18, the very first thing that she did, and she went out and got her ears pierced. You know what? That's great. Yeah. Okay. Your body, your choice. I'm absolutely comfortable with that.
No.
Okay. But the reason why we put those rules in place, we have the concept of statutory rape.
Mm.
For exactly that reason. But people have lost the ability to think clearly around the fundamentals around how this stuff is supposed to work. So you have people who say, for example, no, it's wrong to have underage sex, but it's okay to start giving people hormone blockers so that they can become transgender before they attend legal majority. And they don't actually get the fundamental contradiction between saying that it's right to interfere with someone's body at some level.
I feel we are digressing a little too far from the reasons that we brought Martin on in the first place. But gentlemen, we are out of time. And Martin, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Canton, lots of compliments for you. Mr. P saying Canton is on fire today with firm points, good content. Thank you. Someone else saying thank you for the clarification. Sibang Madongo saying thank you for the clarification, Canton. Ken saying, wasn't all land at some point in time stolen? So what is the starting point for restitution? We don't have time to answer that now. But thank you both very much. This is The Burning Platform. It's brought to you by Nando's. We will see you same time next week. Thanks, Martin.
Cheerio.
Cheers, Canton.
So long, guys. CliffCentral.com